Looking for me, the way C-3PO was looking for R2. So, cleaning up my room, I was given an allotted time, and Rick would come in, and whatever was out of place, he would put in a large trash bag, and then he'd lock it in the trunk of the car. Then I had to do chores to earn money to buy my toys back. I know it sounds harsh, because it is. But to be fair, I could buy. They were priced fairly. Like they were. I could buy entire Millennium Falcons, wind up Evel Knievels, and stuffed monkeys for like a nickel each. Totally reasonable. But Rick, he was hardcore. Like holidays, we weren't even allowed to have friends or family over to the house. He claimed our house was not big enough. So that was not true. Meanwhile, my mother was very emotional and passionate and affectionate. She was wild and funny. She's originally from southern Mississippi and was raised in a very conservative house. And she was always just wanting to make sure that I knew the most important thing in life was to be happy. And she just supported anything I did. Anything I did was so cool, and I always looked adorable, and just everything was great, you know? And like even down to dropping out of high school, my mother would brag to people. She's like, yeah, Tig dropped out, you know? She's doing her own thing. And my own thing, I had nothing going on. Like, I was like working at a pizza parlor or selling po' boys. That was me doing my own thing. And but then I found stand-up comedy. And I immediately had focus in my life. And I was so passionate and excited about it. And my mother, you know, she didn't care if I was in some dingy club in middle America or on TV. She just thought I was cool, you know, as long as I was happy. She was happy. Rick, Rick told me that my career was a waste of my time and a waste of my intelligence. And he thought that I should be a doctor or a lawyer. He suggested that I quit comedy and go to business school. Like, even just a couple of years ago. When my career was going fine, I was making good money. I said, so you're telling me if I quit comedy and went to business school, something I'm not at all interested in, and ended up working in like a cubicle in an office somewhere with the life sucked out of me, you would support that? And he said, absolutely. I was like, wow. Okay. So, although my mother was very supportive of me, we certainly had our differences and problems. And I remember one time, like a decade ago, being on the phone, fighting. And when the argument wasn't going anywhere, when I was mid-sentence, she just abruptly handed the phone to Rick. And he said, Tig, your mother doesn't want to talk to you. And he just hung up on me. And I kept calling back, no answer. It was so frustrating and stifling. And this March, my phone rang, and the word parents popped up on my caller ID. And I was like, oh, this is probably my mother calling to wish me a happy birthday. Because a couple of days before was my birthday and I had missed her call. And when I answered the phone, it was Rick. And Rick has only called me like 2 times in my entire life. One was to tell me, I have no idea what that was about. And the second time was this time, and he was calling to tell me that my mother had fallen and hit her head and was not going to make it. And I immediately pictured her lying in a hospital, just barely hanging on, saying, you know, call Tig, tell her to come to Texas to say goodbye. And I said, can I talk to my mother? You know, put her on the phone. He said, no, you can't ever talk to her again. My mother had suffered massive brain hemorrhaging with zero chance of recovery. And it was really so intense to process that, that I would never be able to talk to her again. I've reflected a lot recently about that phone call over a decade ago when we were arguing. And I've thought about how I know my mother would give anything in the world to be able to come back to talk to me. And I always think that if somebody could be like, okay, you can come back, but you have to come back to that phone call where you're fighting with Tig, there would be zero fighting. It would be only I love yous and I'm sorrys from both of us. After my mother's funeral, we left Mississippi, our hometown where she was buried, and we were driving back to Texas. And my brother and my uncle were in one car, and Rick and I were in the other. And we were driving, and he said, Tig, I want to talk to you about something. And I was like, oh, great. Look at this. Would this be not in the mood? And he said, I wanted to talk to you about that time that you said that I hurt your feelings. The time that I hurt your feelings when I told you you should go to business school. And I said, oh, yeah. That hurt my feelings, but what really hurt my feelings was telling me my career was a waste of my time and a waste of my intelligence. That was hurtful. And he said, and he started to cry. The robot started to cry. And he said, I was wrong, and I wanted to apologize for that. He said that I never understood you as a child. I didn't get you at all. And I tried to project onto you my life and my route, and I expected you to take that exact same route. And I'm realizing that it's not the child's responsibility to teach the parent who they are. It's the parent's responsibility to learn who the child is. And I didn't do that. And I'm sorry. And I said, so, and I'm crying too. I said, are you saying that if I said I was going to quit comedy and go to business school, you wouldn't support that anymore? And he said, absolutely not. He said, that is the only thing in the world that you should be doing. And I was like, oh my gosh. I didn't even realize that I needed that so desperately to hear that. And the only thing that really bums me out is that my mother wasn't there to hear that, to hear him tell me that. This Thanksgiving, I went to Texas, and we actually spent it with Rick's side of the family. And I needed to get away and just be by myself, and I decided to drive to my mother and Rick's house. And when I pulled up into the driveway, I just had a full-on breakdown, just sobbing in the driveway. Because I was like, oh my gosh, my mother is not in that house. And of course I knew that, but it just really hit me in the driveway. And then I walked inside, and the house still smelled like her. And everything was just so quiet. I was just looking around, and still photos that were framed just seemed so still. Just moments in time caught and just gone forever. And all the photos were still just placed where my mother had placed them over the years. And I started opening drawers because I wanted to just see something of my mother. She would write little notes to herself, like, you know, Dennis, 2 p.m. tomorrow. And she was an artist. And she would sketch me perfectly on a napkin when I was just sitting around. And so I was just looking for those kinds of things in the drawers, and there wasn't anything in there. And I went to open a closet, and there's nothing there. And I was finding nothing in any drawers or closets, and I just started going around the house, just running around, just trying to find something. And then I was in this panic and just crying even harder. Like, Rick had gutted the house out like he had when I was a child with a trash bag. Everything was gone. And I was like, I'm done with this person. I couldn't believe I had fallen for that conversation. And I was so ready to write him off immediately. I was done. And I called him on my cell phone. And he said, hello, Tig, how are you doing? I said, not good. Not good. All of my mother's things are gone. And so are my childhood things. And he said, oh, hold on a minute. Go into my bedroom. Go into my closet. And he started directing me. And I was like, yeah. He said, look at the top shelf. And up there, he had placed some of my mother's things and some of my childhood things. And, you know, I opened the box, and she was a dancer too. There were her ballet slippers and photos. And I just was like, you're lucky. And although, you know, before March, when the word parents popped up on my caller ID, it represented my mother and Rick. Now, when the word parents pops up on my caller ID, it's only Rick. We have very different cleanup techniques. But I'm learning to get used to that. So, good night.
That was Tig Notaro. Tig is a stand-up comic. She has a popular podcast called Professor Blastoff, and she also writes for film and TV.
The Moth Radio Hour is produced by Atlantic Public Media in Woods Hole, Massachusetts, and presented by the Public Radio Exchange, PRX.org.
And you are listening to WILO. My name is John Steinbach. I'm the membership director. I'm joined in the studio by our COO, Bob Colquhoun. We're very excited to be joining you this morning and listening to The Moth. It is the Tuesday of our October pledge drive. And hey, what a great story, the kind of stuff you only get here on public radio and on The Moth.
It is a great story. The Moth is a great program that we're bringing to our listeners. Man, to follow up that story, though. She did it with humor. She did it with grace. She did it with knowledge and caring. And you could feel the conflict that she was having with her dad. And I don't know how to describe it anymore. You know?
Yeah, right.
There are things where, you know, I actually had personal experiences like that. And it's like, wow, this is just a terrific story. And she's doing it so gracefully. And you're listening to it here on WILL. John, like you said, this is the type of the thing that only we do.
Absolutely.
And it's just a terrific story. This is a great program. You know, you can be part of a great day for us, too, by giving us a call at 217-244-9455 and state a pledge of your support. You know, we reach out to many cities throughout the area, and we would love to hear from you this morning.
That's right. We have a few people to thank. We'd like to thank Bob from Onarga, Ruth from Posotum, and Nancy from Urbana. Thank you all very much for pledging your support of WILL here during our fall radio drive. Our goal by Friday is to raise $95,000. It's a very important goal. As we look to the fundraising year, we try and be very responsible with our fundraising and ensure that the station is in secure financial shape so we can continue to bring shows like The Moth and Fresh Air, which is coming up next. Later today, you'll have Here and Now. We have, obviously, All Things Considered, Morning Edition. So many great programs throughout the schedule. We hope you think it's worth your time and worth a pledge of support. And you can do that right now. During this drive, we're really looking for people who previously maybe were annual donors or who are brand new donors to consider becoming a sustaining donor. There's several amounts that work for that. If you're new, we recommend $5 a month. It's very easy and a great way to get set up. You can give $10 a month, $25 a month, whatever fits in your budget. We accept credit cards, electronic funds transfer from your bank account, or you can do it, if you're University of Illinois, payroll deduction. And, of course, if you'd prefer to make your regular annual gift, we love that as well. Again, the number is 217-244-9455, or you can go to willpledge.org. And now we'll get back to The Moth.
This is The Moth Radio Hour from PRX. I'm Sarah Austin-Jeunesse. Our next story was told by musician Samuel James at a show in Portland, Maine. The theme of the night was Leap of Faith.
I was 12 years old, and I was in my third foster home, and my very first foster father had just called, and he called to say that he was very sorry to hear about my mother, but what he didn't know is that nobody had told me that she was dead. So I was in foster homes because my parents drank. They weren't bad people. I always felt loved. But when they weren't drinking, they were better parents. And they were drinking more and more frequently. And eventually people started to notice. I never noticed because I didn't have another childhood to compare it to. So when I got taken out of my home, I was very confused and very upset. And when I found out that she had died, I just got empty. You know, I just hollowed out. And then when no one else called to say that she had died is when I started to get really angry. You know, like, burn the world angry. And being a kid, a black kid in foster homes in Maine, and burn the world angry, there's not a lot of foster homes that want to hang on to you for very long. So I started going through them pretty quick. I learned the magic number was 5. If you get to 5 foster homes, you're marked, and people don't want to hang on to you at all anymore. You're trouble. So you can't get placement, and you are homeless. And then you go into shelters. And a shelter you can only stay in for 30 days, and you're on to the next, and on to the next. This is affectionately called the shelter shuffle. So the education you get in the shelter is nothing to mention. When I was a little boy, I remember my father telling me that because I am black, I will have to be twice as smart as the smartest white man in the room to get recognized half as much. So education was always a very important thing to me. So I knew I had to straighten out. So when I was 14 and I got my 7th foster home, I knew I had to hang on to this for dear life, no matter the cost. So I get to my 7th foster home. The caseworker drops me off. I bring all my stuff into the room, my room, which was in the basement. They're almost always in the basement. And I'm really nervous because I don't want to mess this up. So I go up onto the porch and I light a cigarette. Yeah, you're ahead of me on this one. The foster father comes out, and then it hits me that maybe this man that the state has put in charge of me might have something to say about this. But he doesn't. Instead, he leans on the railing with me and lights his own cigarette. And I think, this is beautiful. This is just me and him watching the sunset over the pines. Beautiful, beautiful. And he turns to me and he says, yep, I never had no problem with coloreds. Yeah, and I think, well, with an attitude like that, how could you? So this man, it turns out, wasn't the prince you might think. He, there was another foster child there, and he was 12 years old, and he had fetal alcohol syndrome, and this man liked to torture him. And this man also had a dog who was old and dying, and he liked to kick this dog. It wasn't going well, and it becomes this frustration where this is your life, and you can't do anything about it. You can't help him, you can't help the dog, you can't help yourself. It's like you're starving to death, and there's one source of food, and it's this apple down between these rocks. And you can reach your hand in and grab it, but you can't pull it out while holding it. And this is your life. But on the bus to school, there was this cute little brunette sitting by herself, nose in a book, named Jenny. And that was usually what I would do. So one day I asked her if she wanted to be loners together. Yeah, she laughed. And I have to tell you that it is so great to have somebody in your life who laughs. So I'm talking to her on the bus every day, and pretty soon we're talking every night on the phone. And that's going really well, but back at the foster home, things are going worse and worse and worse. And there's this family, foster family get-together, dinner party, and during this, the foster father blows up at me and he calls me a black bastard in front of everybody in the room. It wasn't the first time I'd heard a racial slur out of his mouth, but it wasn't that. It was the rage in his voice, and it was the fact that it was a room full of people, and it was the fact that when I looked at every pair of eyes in the room, they all just went to the floor. I was abandoned and completely alone, and nobody had my back. And this is when the panic sets in, where it's finally too hard to stay, and I have to go. So the next morning, my caseworker drops me off at the shelter. And at this point, I'm completely accepting of this because I'm not going to get an 8th foster home. It's very clear I'm not going to make it 3 more years at this place. So this is the best I'm going to do. But I take my allotted phone time at night, and I still call Jenny. And I don't tell her where I am because I just lost my one chance to go to college. I just lost, because I moved so much, I've lost every friend I've ever had, including her. She just doesn't know it yet, and as long as I can keep her on the phone, she won't. But eventually it slips out, and I can't remember what she said. I can't think of a reaction at all. I just remember getting empty again and hanging up. And I waited the next week to call her, and almost immediately she hands the phone to her father. Now, at this point, I've had a lot of conversations in my life about don't call the house again, don't come by here, you're a bad influence. But that's not the conversation I have. What he says to me is, would you like to come live with us? Now, when I tell you that, you need to understand that my relationship with Jenny had been only on the phone or on the bus. She'd never been to my house, I'd never been to hers. And her father, who I'm talking to right now, had never even met me. He'd never seen my face. The first contact we're having is right now on the phone. So when he asked me if I want to do this, my visceral gut reaction is, hell no. Because I have actual blood relatives that did not take me in when I went into foster care. No family had ever done me any good. But my father raised me from a very young age to know it's okay to be scared, but not to ever be stupid. So I said yes. And my caseworker drops me off at Jenny's, and it is a huge, beautiful place. And everybody there has huge, beautiful smiles. Her father, her mother, her four siblings. And a bigger bunch of overachievers in your life you have never seen. None of them seen an A-minus ever. And this was the time when I realized that for the first time in my life, I am in way over my head. Because prior to this, everything had been about survival, but this was going to have to be about betterment and achievement. And while this is happening, my father is trying to prove to the state that he's got his act together, and eventually we get to a place where we get a supervised visit. Now, a supervised visit means this. It's him and me and a caseworker in a very stale, fluorescently lit office. And I am petrified because I've always lived by these little credos that my father has left me. But there's a part of me that thinks, oh, I might have made this up just to get through. Maybe he's the drunk jerk that they think he is, but I need him to be the man that I think he is. And I get in there, and he's the man I think he is. So eventually we get a visit where he gets to come to Jenny's. And he comes to Jenny's, and they are naturally protective of me and a little trepidatious about this. And they have an old piano, and I mentioned, you know, that my father plays the piano. What I don't say is that my father is a world-class jazz pianist. So when he sits down to play the piano, the only thing more beautiful than the sound coming out is the sound of all of the family's jaws hitting the floor at once. And in this, I'm sure it was a really surreal moment for them, he becomes real to them as well. And they begin to champion me and him and us getting together. And eventually, I go back to live with him. And eventually, I go to college. And the other day I was talking to Jenny about this very thing, and I told her that the thing that sticks with me about it is that I was a really angry kid. I wasn't a good kid, and these people took me in, and by no means did I pay them back with kindness when I was there. I was still very, very angry, and it hangs on me that I didn't treat them as well as they treated me. And Jenny said, I don't remember you being a bad kid. I think you're being too hard on yourself. And I can't tell if she's right, and I am being too hard on myself, or if she's just as kind as somebody raised by her parents should be.
That was Samuel James, live from Portland, Maine.
The Moth Radio Hour is produced by Atlantic Public Media in Woods Hole, Massachusetts, and presented by the Public Radio Exchange, PRX.org.
And you're listening to Moth here on WILL. My name is John Steinbacher. I'm here with Bob Colkeen. We're here to ask you to support great programs like The Moth. Another amazing story, another thing that you're only going to get right here on The Moth on WILL. Just a really another, you know, moving story of Samuel's sort of journey through foster care and how things ended up in the end.
Sound like a long edition of StoryCorps.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, I mean, it's really pulling at your heart strings, telling a good story, challenging the system, and telling you things that you don't hear on other radio stations. you like this type of programming, which is important, give us a call at 217-244-9455 and state your pledge of support. Consider a sustainer level of $60 a year, which is $5 per month, or $72, which is $6 per month, or a great level is $120, and that's $10 per month there. The phone number, again, is 217-244-9455. Now, Moth Radio Hour can be heard on Saturday at its regular time at 1 o'clock. So what we're hoping to is attract listeners to that regular scheduled program. It is on during this time block right now, basically as we are refurbishing a program that we have for local and regional program that we will be bringing back in January. And we're looking at different programs that are interesting, thought-provoking, and that our listeners have told us that they enjoy hearing. So this is why we put this in at this time. Give us a call again, 217-244-9455. You know, it's a great, great program.
That's right, and everyone who makes a gift today will be entered into a special giveaway. Harvest Bread Company in Champaign has offered a fresh-baked good basket with breads, rolls, cookies, other treats, plus bread for a year. So that's one loaf of bread
a year.
Monthly for 12 months. So just a little extra incentive. We know Lisa and Rick, who run that place, are very big fans of WIL. Encourage your support at 217-244-9455 or go online to willpledge.org. Thank you.
This is the Moth Radio Hour from PRX. Our final story is from Andrew Solomon and was told live at the New York Public Library. The theme was OMG, Stories of the Sacred.
A lot of my work is about resilience. I've written about it in a whole range of contexts. I wrote about it among artists who were responding to the Soviet Union. I wrote about it in the context of a fat book about depression. And having been so interested in resilience and so interested in art, I was fascinated to think about a place where there was no art. And under the Taliban in Afghanistan, there was no art at all. And so I decided that I would go there immediately after the American invasion and see what happened after the Taliban had fallen. Now, there are arguments to be made that if you are gay and Jewish with an anxiety disorder and a tendency toward depression, a field trip to war-ravaged Afghanistan may not be incredibly sound judgment. And there were those who tried to discourage me. But I went, and when I got there, I thought, this is a whole new level of anxiety. And I thought, but at least I've got my story to do. So my first port of call was the UN, because that was sort of the center of everything that was happening. And I went and I met with someone at the UN, and I said, I've come, I'm doing a story, the New York Times agreed to send me, and I'm going to write about the resurgence of art in Afghanistan following the fall of the Taliban. I said, and you've been living here for some time. I said, do you know any artists? And he said, there are no artists in Afghanistan. And I said, well, maybe some poets or some musicians? And he said, there are no poets in Afghanistan. He said, but there's someone downstairs whose sole job actually has been to look at the music of Afghanistan and in fact try to get it out into the world. And he'd probably know all about the musicians. So if you just go downstairs, you could talk to him, and I imagine he'll be able to help you. And I thought that would be great, because, well, I could just about imagine a world without film and without photography and without acting and without poetry and without any kind of figurative visual art. I couldn't really imagine a country without music, a country where it had been illegal for a mother to hum to her child. People had been arrested for that. A country where it was illegal even to clap. And so I went downstairs to the man who'd come to study music in Afghanistan, and I did my little patter song, and I said I was there to write about all of these things. And I said, and I wondered, you've been studying this. I said, can you tell me about some musicians in Afghanistan? And he said, there is no music in Afghanistan. And I thought, I've come quite a long way to get the story of how there is actually no art or music in Afghanistan. And fortunately, I had a translator with me, my translator Farouk, who was and is an amazing friend, and who had trained as a doctor under the Taliban, which meant that each day he had 8 hours of instruction, 7 hours of religious instruction, and 1 hour of medical instruction. And he felt that he didn't really know enough to be a doctor and had decided to be a translator for a while he tried to educate himself. And Farouk said to me, you know, I don't know much about the things you're interested in. He said, but there is actually a museum in Kabul. It's small, but it's the National Gallery of Afghanistan. And they're sort of reopening it later today. And we could probably get into that if you wanted to go. And I said, I would definitely like to go. And we went off to the museum, and we went in, and on the walls of the museum, there were a lot of empty landscapes. And of course, the Taliban had said that the representation of the human figure, or even of animals, was contrary to Islamic law, a debatable point, but one that they had held. And it turned out that there was an artist, Dr. Asifi, who had, when the Taliban came to power, gone into the museum at night with a set of watercolors, and he had painted over all of the figures within the paintings. And when we got there, Dr. Asifi was there, and he had a bucket of water, and he had a piece of cloth. And Karzai, who seemed like the great hope at that point, had come for this opening as well, and the electricity kept going out the way it did everywhere in Kabul that winter. And Dr. Asifi carried his bucket, and he dipped his piece of cloth in, and he began to rub the surface of one of the paintings. And suddenly, everything began to appear. The figures came out, the animals came out, what the painting was about came out, and everyone burst into applause. And Dr. Asifi said to me that he had a friend who was the greatest painter of miniatures. The Persian miniature is an art that began in Herat, and the Afghans therefore claim it as their own. And he said, go and see this guy who does the miniatures. And there was no phone system in Afghanistan at that point, and there was no postal system, and there was certainly no fax or email, and the only way to see anyone was to go and show up where they were. So I got the address of this other artist, and I went off to see him, and he showed me these exquisite miniatures that he was painting. And I said, they're very, very beautiful. I said, but they seem very, very traditional. I said, are you introducing any kind of innovation? And he said to me, you come from the West, where the past is safe, and so you can make things that are about the future. But for those of us in Afghanistan, whose past has been very nearly annihilated, we have to secure the past before we can even begin to think about the future. And he said to me, if you want to understand these feelings, he said, I do know a poet who has gone back to writing secular poetry. You should go and see him. And so the next day we went to see the poet, and we showed up at his house, and he showed me some of his poems, one of which said, on the highest escarpment, on the sharpest peak, inscribe this epitaph of a futureless generation, that instead of mother's milk, we were given guns, and instead of education, we were given war. Don't blame us. We could do nothing for you. And he said to me, you should talk to other people who are writing and other people who are doing things. And he gave me a few more names and addresses. And one of them was for a woman who was doing poetry with some other women, and we went to their house, and they agreed to come and meet with us someplace else. And when they walked in, they were all wearing burqas, and they took off the burqas so that we could sit and talk, and they were incredibly sophisticated and cosmopolitan. And I said, the Taliban has fallen. Why are you still wearing that thing? Why is everyone in Kabul still wearing those burqas? And one of them said, well, I'm wearing it because they might come back to power, and if they do, they'll punish anyone who went out without one. And one of them said, I'm wearing this because if I get raped or beaten up, people will say it was my own fault. And then the third one, who was the poet, said, I always thought if the Taliban fell, I would burn this thing and I would never put it on again. But you know, after 5 years, you get used to being invisible, and the prospect of being visible again is very overwhelming. She was the one who said to me, there's a lot of music. There's a lot of music. And she said, this is the best singer. You should go and see this man. And she gave me his name and his address. And so the next day we went to his house and we arrived and he greeted us and he was very warm and we stood outside the house for a minute and I said to him, you're a singer. I said, you couldn't sing for all of these years. You had no music at all. I said, didn't you go crazy? Wouldn't one go crazy having no music at all? And he said, at the beginning, I thought I would go crazy. He said, but then I realized that there was a kind of music that even the Taliban couldn't forbid. He said, come in. And we walked into his house. And as we were walking in, he said, a few months after they came to power, I went to the market and I bought 20 pigeons and I bought 20 doves. And they've lived in the house with me ever since. And we sat in his room while these doves and pigeons flew around us in circles. The room was a mess. And he said, that was the music. And he said, if you're really interested in music, he said, there's actually a group of amazing musicians who are really trying to bring back the great Afghan classical tradition. He said, they practice most afternoons in the basement of a building opposite the television tower. Go there and hear what they're doing. So that afternoon, Farouk and I went off to hear the other musicians. And when we arrived, they were in this basement. It was cold in Kabul. It was February. There was no heating anywhere. They were sitting there and they were playing with gloves on string instruments, which I must say does not improve the performance. But nonetheless, they were playing beautifully. And I sat and I watched them. And at the end of an hour, they said, you seem so interested. They said, do you have any questions for us? And I said, if you weren't able to play for all those years, how did you remember these instruments and what to do with them? And one of them said to me, you know, we couldn't practice in real life during the day, but I practiced every night in my dreams. And then I said to one of them, the instrument you're playing, I know that's a traditional Afghan instrument. All the instruments were supposed to be destroyed when the Taliban came to power. How did you keep it? And in good shape, too. And he said, oh, yes, this is a serindar. He said, and what I did was I had a wood pile behind the house where I kept all of the wood, and I put the serindar in the middle of the wood pile. And every few days, I'd bring in some more logs, or I'd take some logs away, and I'd rearrange it. And if you were only looking at it from the end, it could pass for scrap wood. And I knew that if any of my neighbors reported me, I could get stoned to death, he said. But it gave me such comfort to know it was there in the pile. And then I said, I've loved hearing your music. And they said, but you know, there are only 7 of us here today. And there are actually 11 in our group. We could get the whole group together if you want to hear us all play. And I said, I would love that. And they said, well, when do you want to do it? And I said, how about Friday? And they said, sure, Friday would be good. And I said, afternoon, 5 o'clock? And they said, 5 o'clock would be great. And then I had a little inspiration. And I said, I'm happy to come back and hear you playing here again. I know this is where you practice. But actually, a group of journalists and I rented an old Al-Qaeda house, which were the only houses that actually did have heating in Kabul at that point. They said, and maybe you'd like to come and play someplace where you didn't have to have gloves on your hands to play string instruments. And they said, that would be fantastic. And I said, great, so 5 o'clock Friday, this is where I'm living, I'll see you then. And then we left, and I thought, wow, I have 11 musicians coming to play in the house at 5 o'clock on Friday. And I thought, those poets we saw and that other singer, we should invite them to come and hear these guys. These guys are really amazing. And I thought we should find the artists we saw. And then I thought, and I'd love to invite Marla, my friend Marla, the human rights activist who was living down the block and who was killed in Iraq and who I miss. And I wanted to invite the other journalists with whom I was sharing the house. And I had to invite the man from the UN who had told me that there was no music in Afghanistan. And I thought, I'll just invite all the people I've met. I had been there only a week, but I had met a lot of people. And Farouk and I spent Thursday going around and inviting people, and we invited everyone. And there was a guy who cooked at the house where we were staying, and I said to him, there's going to be a bunch of people coming on Friday. Could you by any chance provide some snacks for people? And he said, I could make dinner if you want me to. And I said, I don't think you could make dinner. I said, there'll be 80 or 90 people coming here. And he said, oh, he said, 80 or 90. He said, well, the only way I could make dinner for 80 or 90 people would be if I got an assistant and I had money to buy ingredients and, you know, that's a big thing. And I said, well, I understand that. I said, what would be involved in that? He said, you know, that would cost, I mean, it could be $150, it could be even $200 to do dinner for 90. And I said, I'm going to spring for it. And I said, you go ahead and do that. And so the next day, it was Friday, and at 5 o'clock the musicians arrived, and they sat down, and they began to play. And it was so long since they'd had an audience, and they'd had people who wanted to listen. And the Afghans came, and the foreigners who I'd got to know came, and the guy from the UN came, and everyone came, and there was this amazing buffet dinner. I went to Afghanistan to do a piece for the New York Times, but after I returned, I did a piece for Food and Wine magazine. But we sat there, and everyone ate, and the musicians were so enraptured by having us all there that they would get up one at a time to get some food or to do something, but they just never stopped playing, and they went on and they played and they played, and the Afghans started showing the rest of us how to do certain kinds of traditional dancing to the music, and we began dancing, and they played, and we ate, and someone showed up with a bottle of whiskey, which was strictly contraband in Afghanistan at that point. It was sort of like being in 10th grade and having someone show up at your party with a bag of weed. And I taught Farouk in English so he could teach as well as he could in some relevant language, everyone else, the word for hangover, which was a word they had not previously needed. And they just went on playing, and the music seemed to get more beautiful the more they played, and the more they played together, and it was warm, and it was glowing, and there was a curfew in Kabul at 10 o'clock, and you couldn't be in the streets past 10 o'clock. And so at 9:30, I began saying to people, Do you want to get home? It's going to be 10 o'clock soon. I said it to the musicians, and the musicians said, oh, it would take us an hour and a half to get home. We've missed the curfew. We'll have to stay. And the guests started saying, oh, I can't leave while this is happening. And the musicians went on playing, and the curfew was a curfew until dawn. And they played until 6 o'clock the following morning without ever taking a break. 13 solid hours of music. And afterwards, I thought to myself that when I'd written about depression, I had said, there's a kind of joy which is possible only after you've been profoundly depressed. And I realized there's a kind of music that is possible only after you've been silent for 5 years, and that I had been the fortunate witness to those extraordinary sounds and to that sacred and holy moment when the music began again. I told Farouk a few days ago on Skype that I was going to tell this story, and we had a long talk about it and went over some of the details. And when we finished, Farouk, for whom I have tried to get a visa to come here now for almost 10 years, Farouk said to me, I'm so glad that you'll tell that story and that people will be able to remember the moment of hope when the American invasion had just happened and we were so joyful and had such belief in what we thought was going to come. Thank you.
That was Andrew Solomon. Andrew is an award-winning author.
The stories in this Moth Radio Hour fundraising special were directed by Sarah Austin Jeunesse, Meg Bowles, and Catherine Burns. The rest of the Moth directorial staff includes Sarah Haberman and Jennifer Hickson. Production support from Whitney Jones. Moth stories are true as remembered and affirmed by the storytellers. Moth events are recorded by Argo Studios in New York City, supervised by Paul Ruest. Our theme music is by The Drift. The Moth is produced for radio by me, Jay Allison, at Atlantic Public Media in Woods Hole, Massachusetts, with help from Vicki Merrick. This hour was produced with funds from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the National Endowment for the Arts, and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. The Moth Radio Hour is presented by the Public Radio Exchange, PRX.org. For more about our podcast, for information on pitching your own story, and everything else, go to our website, themoth.org.
And you've listened to The Moth here on WILL. Coming up in just a few short moments, we're going to have today's episode of Fresh Air with Terry Gross. And in just a moment before that, we'll have a quick update on ag. But right now, we're going to take just a minute and a half or 2 minutes right now to ask for your support in for great programming like The Moth, great storytelling you only get on public radio. This is really just three fantastic stories there.
Absolutely. You know, Heather Miller, our producer here, has many, many different things that are in our studio that are hanging on the wall to make us smile, to make us think about the great audience that we are talking to right now. And one of the things that's up there, it says, being better informed makes you a smarter citizen. Now, this is throughout our whole day that we think about this, through our news and public affairs programming, but none better than what we just did with The Moth. When you think about the three stories that came through today, I said they reminded me of the StoryCorps, the extended version of StoryCorps. They were really good human interest stories. I hope you have enjoyed them. I hope you feel that you can apply some of the storytelling that was done today to your lives and, you know, become a better person listening to these type of things. You know, that's one of the things that we really like to do to inform our audience. The phone number is 217-244-9455. It's up to you to be an active listener. Go to the phone and give us a call.
That's right, and we are getting very close to passing $25,000 for our drive. I think one or two more gifts, depending on where they're at, will put us over the $25,000 mark. That is really important as we